About 10 months ago, on October the 6th of 2019, to be precise, I gave a lesson that I had entitled Honoring the King, A Proper Attitude Towards Our Political Leaders. And in that lesson, I noted that there is, among a wide swath of the population of our country, a great disdain for and disrespect of many of our highest-ranking political leaders. And because of these ill feelings towards these particular leaders, much has been done to undermine, reject, and rebel against our current leadership. And if you'll remember in that lesson, I observed that this cannot be the way that we as Christians view, talk about, or interact with our political leaders. And that is true irregardless of whether or not we think they are good moral people, irregardless of whether or not we think that they are making good and wise decisions, and irregardless of whether or not we agree with the policies that they are enacting. We must still be respectful of those who are in these positions over us. And unfortunately, it would appear that matters have only deteriorated in our country since last October. And this sense of entitlement to be able to reject and cast off the authority of those who are governing over us has now trickled down not just to rejecting the president or rejecting a certain political party, but now even in our local communities, authority is being rejected and fought against at almost every level. In the wake of the shutdown and the mandatory stay-at-home orders that occurred throughout much of the United States, which was itself prompted by the coronavirus scare this past spring, there's been much unrest. And the death of George Floyd at the hands of some Minneapolis police officers appeared, at least initially, to be the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. And since that time, political unrest, outrage, violence, and anarchy have ensued throughout our country. I did not think I would live to see a day where there would be riots in the streets of American cities. And yet, they are abundant. And along with the riots comes all sorts of criminal activity, whether that be the looting of stores and establishments, or the theft from other people, or the destruction of property, whether that be the tearing down of statues and public monuments, or the burning of federal buildings, or the destruction of local businesses. Not to mention the violence that's occurring and the beating of people who disagree and the outright murder of those who would speak differently than the politically correct viewpoint. The reality is that mobs have been gathering and demanding change in our nation. And all for what? Because of a claim of some unfettered police brutality? And the idea that our country is systemically or institutionally racist? Now, I'll be honest, I don't want to get into a debate today over racism, whether it be systemic, institutional, or otherwise. There will be a time and a place to have that discussion, but that's not today. Because today, in light of the frenzy to promote reform within our nation, which has given rise to recent calls to defund and disband and reject the authority of the police force throughout the United States, and more importantly, the hostility that's being promoted and prompted and directed towards law enforcement officers specifically, and in a more general sense, the attack that is happening against the idea of law and order in our country, we might be sitting here wondering, where should the Christian line up on these issues? What attitude and interactions should we as Christians have towards the law enforcement community? You know, I thought these would be questions we would never need to address, but I find that it's necessary so that we know what we believe and why we believe it and what we should do before we have a problem in our own back door, backyard. And so this morning, I want to spend some time talking about this question. How should Christians view and interact with the police? And the first thing that I would like to do is I would like to establish clearly the fact that law enforcement is indeed authorized by God. If you haven't done so already, open your Bibles to Romans chapter 13 and maybe put your marker there, keep your finger there, because we'll be coming back and referencing this text quite regularly throughout the lesson. But let's read verses 1 through 7 just to set the stage for our discussion. Romans chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, the Apostle Paul says, "Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." Here in this text, the Apostle Paul makes the observation that civil government, governing authorities, are indeed a minister of God to us for good, and also a minister of God to those who are of God's wrath to those who would do evil. And this idea of being a minister, it's actually the word here, diakonos, which that sounds like our word, deacon, the function within the church where it is a role that has been given, an act of service, one who serves. And the word diakonos puts in relationship the one who is doing the serving, not so much in relationship to the one whom they're serving, that's the idea of doulos, a servant, a slave, but diakonos is speaking of the one who does the work in relationship to the work that they have been given to do. So it's emphasizing the work that has been entrusted to them. And this idea that civil government is described as a minister of God to us for good, if you do good, and it's also a minister of God to exercise wrath against those who do evil, indicates that God has indeed given a work to the civil government that is from him that he expects them to execute and carry out. And specifically, this work is to uphold those who do what's right and those who do evil, to punish them. Keep your finger here in Romans 13 and turn over to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 13, Peter writes, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to the governors as sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right." And so this work that God has given to government, to the civil authorities, is that they are supposed to praise the people who do what is good and right, and those who do what is evil and wicked, they are supposed to punish those people. And indeed, this function, this work, is something that God himself has ordained and established. You notice there in Romans chapter 13 and verse 1 that we are to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority, including governing authorities, except from God, and those which exist, including governing authorities, are established by God. In other words, God put civil government in place. He established it. He ordained it. He gave it authority to make sure that people do what is right. In other words, to enforce the laws. And if somebody does not abide by the laws, the civil government is given authority to punish those who do wrong, those who break the law. And indeed, if that's the intended purpose, if that's why God gave civil government and civil authorities and law enforcement, was to praise those who do good and to punish those who do evil, those who break the law, well, Paul's statement in verse 3 makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? He says, "For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil." Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good and you'll have praise from the same. I'll tattle on myself a little bit. From the time I was 16 to the time I was, 23, 24 maybe, driving in my car, any time that a cop pulled up behind me, the old heart started going. And I would immediately look down at the speedometer and see how fast was I going. And oh man, I was going too fast. And then the lights come on. And now I'm really anxious. And I pull over to the side of the road and my heart's pounded. And the cop gets out and walks up and goes, "Hello, officer. What's going on?" And I just was a nervous wreck. I had a fear of the authorities because I knew that I wasn't doing what I ought to do. But you know what happens to me now when I see a police officer pull out behind me? I think, well, he must be going after that person up there because I know he's not going after me. And even if the lights come on behind me, my first thought is not, well, he must be pulling me over. It must be I need to get out of his way so that he can get around because he's got something important to do. Because I try to make it a habit of not speeding anymore. And that's the idea. If you're doing what's right, you don't have to fear that the authorities are going to come out and get you. But if you're not doing what's right, well, your heart's going to get a little bit of an exercise. That's this idea here, because that's what the law enforcement, that's what the government, that's what civil authorities are supposed to do. And make no mistake about this, that God has given government the authority to punish evil doers. This idea in verse 4, that it's a minister of God for good, but it is, does not bear the sword for nothing, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. That idea there of not bearing the sword in vain, it's not an empty threat that the government has to be able to punish those who do what is wrong, those who violate the law. And you'll notice back in chapter 12 of Romans in verse 19, Paul had previously told the brethren, never take your own revenge, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says who? Says the Lord. The Lord says, vengeance belongs to me. I am the one who will exercise my wrath against those who do what's wrong, who do what's evil. But notice here in this text, he says that the civil government is acting as the servant of God to do what? To exercise wrath, to avenge, to take the vengeance of the Lord, to bring about his wrath against those who practice evil. And so even though vengeance belongs to the Lord, we need to recognize that God can and does use man to enforce or carry out or exercise his wrath against evildoers. And this concept of God delegating his authority to man to take punitive action against evildoers goes at least as far back as the days of Noah. You remember in Genesis chapter 9, after Noah and his family have come off of the ark, And they're the only ones who are alive, and God is reestablishing his covenant with man. And some of the rules that God gives them and instruction that he gives them beginning in chapter 9, notice what he says in verse 5. He says, "Surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast, I will require it. And from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. And whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed." Why? "For in the image of God he made man." Now in this section, God has been instructing Noah and his family about what they can and cannot eat. And the idea that they're not supposed to eat the blood of animals because life is in the blood. And he goes on to say, not only are you not to eat the life of animals, the blood of animals, but you need to take special care of the lifeblood of man, because man is made in the image of God. And so whereas it's okay to kill an animal to eat it, it is never okay to kill a man, because man is made in the image of God. And God here, early on in man's history, sets the groundwork, the framework for this concept of civil government and man carrying out and enforcing the laws of God. That if a man violates this rule and takes the life of another man, God says that man will be executed by his fellow man. And so we see then, under the law of Moses, that specific instructions were given to the Jewish nation on how they were to handle it if somebody should be killed, either accidentally or intentionally. And there's some specific rules that are given out. You remember the Israelites had the cities of refuge, where if you killed somebody, you could flee to this city of refuge so that you wouldn't be executed immediately. We read, for example, in Numbers chapter 35, beginning in verse 10, God says to Moses, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select for yourselves cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there. And the city shall be for you as a refuge from the avenger." The avenger here in this context seems to be, as best I can tell, the person who's been killed, their next of kin. The blood avenger, he'll be described as. As if somebody in my family is killed by somebody else, I am obligated then to avenge their blood. And God gave provisions for these cities of refuge, so that way if you accidentally killed somebody, you could flee to this city of refuge, and the avenger was prohibited from taking your life, from exacting vengeance. But notice verse 12, it says, "The city shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger, so that the manslayer will not die until he stands before the congregation for trial." You jump down to verse 16, because how are we going to know? If there's supposed to be a trial, if there's supposed to be a hearing, and the congregation is supposed to decide whether or not this person is guilty of murder, or in our terms, maybe manslaughter, accidental death, what is supposed to be the punishment? Well, how do we differentiate? Well, specific rules and guidelines are given in verse 16. If he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he's a murderer, and the murderer shall surely be put to death. If he struck him down with a stone in his hand by which he will die, and as a result he die, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him with a wooden object in the hand, and by which he might die, and as a result he died, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him. And if he pushed him with pushed him of hatred, or threw something at him lying in wait, and as a result he died, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. And the blood avenger shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, or threw something at him without lying in wait, or with any deadly object or stone without seeing it, dropped it on him so that he died while he was not his enemy nor seeking his injury, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. And the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to the city of refuge to which he fled, and he shall live in that city until the death of the high priest who is anointed with the holy oil. So God gives in his law to the Israelites some provisions, right? Because what if you're working on the scaffolding and you drop something off and it lands on somebody's head and he dies? Well, that was an accident. It was manslaughter. It wasn't murder. So there has to be a trial. And before any punishment is executed against this guy, there has to be a trial. There has to be a hearing. We have to hear the defense. And then the congregation has to decide, is he guilty of murder or was it an accident? Well, if he's guilty of murder, they deliver him to the man to the Avenger of Blood, and he executes him. If it was an accident, he has to stay in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But what I want to point out here is that there was a due process of law that had to be followed and carried out before execution could be done. And so we're not talking about this kind of Wild West rules where you kill my brother, I'm going to kill you. No, it was due process. The community was involved. We had the framework for this idea of civil government to take care of and execute the will of God. And it's interesting, we're also given some instruction in Deuteronomy chapter 19 that if somebody is found to be guilty of murder and yet they're hiding out in one of these cities of refuge, they can't claim refuge there anymore. We read in verse 11, but if there is a man who hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and rises up against him and strikes him so that he dies and he flees to one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood that he may die. You shall not pity him, but you shall purge the blood of the innocent from Israel so that it may go well with you. We might think that that's harsh, that's a little Wild West, that's a little bit crazy, but understand it was orderly. God gave specific instructions on how they were to do this to make sure that only the guilty were actually punished. And remember this too, there are some differences under the law of Moses and what we live under today, because the Israelites lived under a theocracy. That is, God was their king. We live under a different form of government today, but the same authority to enforce the laws, to praise those who do what is good, and to punish, even punitively, those who do what is evil, belongs to the civil government today. And I would suggest to you that it is true not only of those who are, quote, voted into office, but even to those who are appointed by them. Did you notice that there in 1 Peter chapter 2? Where Peter urges them to submit to every human institution, whether to a king as the one who is in authority, or to the governors as sent by him. They are the delegates, they are the representatives of the king. They have been appointed by the king to go and execute what? Punishment of evildoers and praise of those who do what is right. I would suggest to you that even today, that idea of submitting to and following those not only who are in these political positions, but also those who are appointed by them to carry out and enforce the law, trickling all the way down to our local law enforcement and the men and women who serve in the police department here in Canton, Illinois, that we have an obligation to submit to them. They have the authority that God has given to the government to punish those who do what is wrong and to praise those who do what is right. And notice also that this idea of punishment of evildoers here in 1 Peter chapter 2, that's actually the same word that is used in Romans chapter 12 and verse 19 when Paul says that vengeance belongs to God. That is, punishment belongs to God. And so we see here clearly that though vengeance or punishment is something that God claims for himself, it is something that in certain instances he has clearly delegated to civil government. And so if that's what God's plan is, then the question becomes for us, what should our attitude be towards those who are in these positions of authority, including the law enforcement people, including police? Well, Paul said there in Romans chapter 13 and verse 1 that every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. We are to submit to the police. And furthermore, we are not to resist the police if we were to have an interaction with them. Because everyone who resists is really not just resisting the police. They are resisting the one who put the police in place, who gave them their authority, they are resisting God. And those who resist God will receive condemnation upon themselves. And what's interesting to me, this idea of resist here, it's the same word that's used in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 13. Where Paul says, therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day and having done everything to stand firm. It's the same word that's used in James chapter 4 and verse 7 where James urges us to draw near to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. When we're talking about resisting the devil, we're talking about withstanding him. We're talking about opposing him. We're talking about refusing to yield to him, not giving him any ground. You will not come here. We will fight against you. That's what we do with the devil when we resist. And Paul is saying here, that is not the way we are to be towards civil authorities. We are not to withstand them. We are not to refuse to yield to them. We are not to oppose them. We are not to fight against civil authorities. Because as I said before, if we do that, the reality is that we are actually resisting God and God's plan. And we will stand condemned before God if we do such. And I would suggest to you that this call to submit and not resist applies even to those in positions of authority that are not living up to the standard to which God would have them. So in other words, God gave these functions, these civil authorities, to praise those who do what's good and to punish those who do what's evil. That's the authority that he's granted to them. Sometimes people abuse that authority. Sometimes they don't live up to that standard. And I think something that we should acknowledge is the fact that throughout the history of the world, probably the vast majority of people who have served in civil government positions or even in law enforcement positions have not been Christians, but have been people of the world. It's interesting to me, in Luke chapter 3, we had this instance where several people are coming out to John the Baptist to be baptized, and they're asking him questions about, what do we need to do? What do we need to change in our lives? And of course, he says to the tax collectors who had asked him in verse 12, what should we do? He says, well, collect no more. Verse 13, he says, collect no more than what you have been ordered to. Why did he say that? Because there was a tendency in the first century for tax collectors to abuse their power and extort money from people to enrich themselves. And John says, you can't do that anymore. Only collect what you're supposed to collect. It's interesting to me, verse 14, some soldiers were questioning him saying, and what about us? What shall we do? And I'll just make this observation. In the first century, there wasn't a separate police force. Those who enforced the law were indeed soldiers. And notice what John says to them. Well, don't take money from anyone by force or accuse anyone falsely. Be content with your wages. I would suggest to you he gave those things because there was probably a tendency among soldiers, those who are enforcing the law, to extort money from people, to take it by force, to not be content with their wages, and when they didn't get their way, they'd lie about somebody and get them out of their way. John says, don't do that. Guys, when we have people of the world, we can't always expect them to not be worldly people. When you have worldly people filling these positions within civil government, it is to be expected that they will sometimes abuse the power that has been given to them. But I would suggest to you that just because there are those who might and do abuse their power, that in no way relieves us of our obligation to submit to them. Consider with me for just a moment the example of Jesus before Pilate in John chapter 19. And notice what Pilate says to Jesus in verse 10. He says, you do not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you? What is Pilate saying there? Pilate's saying, I have the right, I have the power, I have the authority to make a judgment here. And notice what Jesus says. You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. I don't think that Jesus is correcting Pilate here. I think he's simply acknowledging the reality that Pilate indeed had been given authority from above to punish those who do evil, crucify someone who is a wicked person, or to release them, to praise those who do good. That's the authority that came from God. And Jesus is saying, you're right. You do have authority to either say I live or I die. But what Pilate didn't have was the authority to put an innocent person to death. That was an abuse of his power. That was not in keeping with God's plan. That was not what God gave civil government to do. And so in condemning Jesus to death, crucifying an innocent man, Pilate was acting outside the scope of authority that God had delegated to him as a civil leader. And make no mistake, Pilate will be held accountable for that abuse of power, for that sin. But note, Jesus goes on and says, for this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. Jesus observes that those who had lied about him in order to obtain a false conviction, they were even more responsible for the death of Jesus than was Pilate. And yet what's interesting to me here is even though those people who handed Jesus over to Pilate were acting outside of the scope of the authority God had granted to them as civil authorities, and though Pilate was acting outside or contrary to the delegated role of civil government in praising the good and punishing the wicked when he condemned Jesus, an innocent man, to death, what we don't see is Jesus denying that Pilate indeed had authority to pass judgment in this case. Nor do we see Jesus rebelling against Pilate's wrong decision and abuse of his power. And so let me suggest to you that when it comes to our interaction with those who are in authority over us, we need to strive to be at peace with all men. Back there in Romans chapter 12, right before he said, don't take your own vengeance, he had admonished us in verse 18, that as much as it depends on us, be at peace with all men. And I would suggest to you that this idea of us striving to be at peace with all men would include being at peace with those who are ruling over us. Notice in Titus chapter 3. Titus chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, Paul tells Titus to remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed, to malign no one, to be peaceable, to be gentle, showing every consideration for all men. Now, sometimes we want to say, yes, you need to be gentle, you need to be compassionate, you need to show consideration to all of the oppressed people. That's not what he said here. He said to all men, and in this very context, included in that are rulers and authorities to whom we need to submit and obey. And so it's our goal as Christians to try to be at peace, not to be at odds with others. And so let me just make a quick statement to anyone who would be thinking about engaging in some political activism at this point in time. Before you engage or participate in any protests or demonstrations or activist movements, I would strongly caution you to do your due diligence and make sure that you know what those groups who are facilitating these protests, these movements, that you know what they're about, that you know what they stand for, that you know what they're trying to achieve. And so before you go march with anybody, make sure you know what you are marching for. Because Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 5, and though I believe this admonition is primarily in the context of within the church and being careful not to join yourself with false teachers, I think the principle is every bit as true even for us in this regard. Paul tells Timothy, do not, this is 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 22, do not lay hands upon anyone too hastily and thereby share responsibility for the sins of others. Keep yourself free from sin. This idea of laying your hands on someone is the idea of saying, I am with you in this endeavor. I am with you in this effort. And Paul is telling us as Christians, you better be careful that you don't lay your hands on somebody too hastily. You don't give your seal of approval to somebody or some organization's agenda too hastily, because you might be engaging yourself supporting something that is sinful. And he says here, if you're not careful, it's not that you even have to go out and do those things or want those things, but by giving your support, your approval to those organizations, to those movements, if they are engaged in sinful activity, you will share in the responsibility of the sin of another. And as Christians, we are to keep ourselves free from sin. Finally, let me say this. We need to be praying for those who are over us. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, Paul says, first of all, then I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority. We need to be praying for those who are ruling over us, who are protecting us, who are enforcing the laws of the land. We need to be praying for those people, praying that they will be able to do a good job at the job that God has given them to do. Why? So that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life, so that we may be peaceful in all godliness and dignity. And brethren, those who are in authority here in this text would certainly include the members of the law enforcement community. And so far from rebelling against the police or exhibiting hostile attitudes towards them or about them, we as God's people should be striving to cooperate with and submit to them. And above all, we need to be prayerful for them, that they do the work that God has delegated to them to do.